until now. Over the course of those next horrible 25 minutes, as Philip relentlessly zigzags down desolate side streets and across leprous vacant lots running parallel to the interstate, carving their way closer and closer to the heart of town, Brian sees the real Atlanta like a flickering slideshow of forensic crime scene photos outside the tinted windows of the hermetically sealed SUV. He sees blind alleys choked with wreckage, flaming trash heaps, housing projects plundered and abandoned, windows blown out everywhere, stained sheets hanging out of buildings scrawled with desperate pleas for help. This is indeed a city. A primeval necropolis, overcrowded and malodorous with death. And the worst part of it is, they're not yet to the border of the downtown area. At approximately 10:22 a.m. Central Standard Time, Philip Blake manages to find Capitol Avenue, a wide six-lane thoroughfare that wends past Turner Field and then downtown. He turns the stereo off. The silence booms in their ears as they turn onto Capitol and then slowly proceed north. The road is cluttered with abandoned cars, but they're spaced far enough apart for the Escalade to weave in between them. The spires of skyscrapers, off to the left, are so close now they seem to glow in the haze like the mainsails of rescue ships. Nobody says a thing as they roll past oceans of cement on either side of the street. The stadium parking lots are mostly empty, a few golf carts overturned here and there. Vending trucks sit in the corners, all closed up and defaced with graffiti. Scattered dead, way in the distance, wander the gray barrens in the cold autumn daylight. They look like stray dogs about to fall over from malnutrition. Philip rolls down his window and listens. The wind whistles. It has an odd smell to it. A melange of burning rubber, melted circuits, and something oily and hard to identify, like rotting tallow. And something chugs in the distance, vibrating the air like a vast engine. A realization twists in Brian's gut. If the refugee centers are open somewhere to the west, somewhere in the ventricles of the city, wouldn't there be emergency vehicles out here? Signs, checkpoints, armed marshals somewhere, police helicopters? Wouldn't there be some indication, this close to the downtown area, that relief is in sight? Up to this point, over the course of their journey into the city, they've seen only a few potential signs of life. Back on Glenwood Avenue, they thought they saw someone on a motorcycle flash by, but they couldn't be sure. Later on Sydney Street, Nick said he saw someone darting across a doorway, but he wouldn't swear to it. Brian pushes the thoughts out of his mind when he sees the vast tangle of highways forming a cloverleaf about a quarter of a mile away. This sprawling interchange of major arteries marks the eastern border of Atlanta's urban area, the place where Interstate 20 meets up with 85, 75, and 403, and now it sits baking in the cold sun like a forgotten battlefield, clogged with wrecks and overturned semis. Brian feels the Escalade beginning to ascend a steep upgrade. Capitol Avenue rises on massive pilings over the interchange. Philip takes the incline slowly, snaking through an obstacle course of deserted wrecks at about 15 miles an hour. Brian feels a tapping on his left shoulder, and he realizes that Penny is trying to get his attention. He turns and looks at her. She leans over and whispers something to him. It sounds like, "I can't see." Brian looks at her. "You can't see?" She shakes her head and whispers it again. This time Brian understands. "Can you hold it for a minute, kiddo?" Philip hears this and he glances in the rear view. "What's the matter?" She has to pee. "Oh boy," Philip says. "Sorry, pumpkin, you're gonna have to cross your legs for a few minutes." Penny whispers to Brian that she really, really, really has to go. "She's gotta go, Philip," Brian informs his brother. "Really bad. Just hold it for a little bit, pumpkin." They're approaching the zenith of the hill. At night, the view from this part of the city, as a motorist crosses Capitol Avenue, Must be gorgeous. There's a moment coming, about 100 yards in the distance now, when the Escalade will clear the shadow of a tall building to the west. At night, the luminous constellations of city lights come into view at this point, providing a breathtaking panorama of the Capitol Dome in the foreground and the sparkling cathedral of skyscrapers behind it. They clear the shadow of the building, and they see the city spread out before them in all its glory. Philip slams on the brakes. The Escalade lurches to a stop. They sit there for an endless moment, all of them stricken speechless. The street to the left runs along the front of the venerable old marble edifice of the Capitol building. It is one way going the wrong way, completely choked with abandoned cars. But that is not why everyone in the SUV is suddenly thunderstruck. The reason why nobody can muster a word, the silence lasting only a second but seeming to go on for an eternity, is because of what they see coming at them down Capitol Avenue from the north. Penny wets herself. The greeting party, as copious as a Roman army and as slapdash as a swarm of giant arachnids, comes from Martin Luther King Drive a little over a block away. They come from the cool shadows where government buildings block out the sun. And there are so many of them that it takes a moment for the human eye to simply register what it is seeing. All shapes and sizes and stages of deterioration. They emerge from doorways and windows and alleys and wooded squares and nooks and crannies, and they fill the street with the profusion of a disordered marching band, drawn to the noise and smell and advent of a fresh automobile filled with fresh meat. Old and young, black and white, men and women, former businessmen, housewives, civil servants, hustlers, children, thugs, teachers, lawyers, nurses, cops, garbage men, and prostitutes, each and every one of their faces uniformly pale and decomposed, like an endless orchard of shriveled fruit rotting in the sun. 1,000 pairs of lifeless, gunmetal gray eyes locking in unison onto the Escalade. 1,000 feral, primordial tracking devices fixing themselves hungrily on the newcomers in their midst. Over the course of that single instant of horror-stricken silence, Philip makes a number of realizations with the speed of a synapse firing. He realizes he can smell the telltale odor of the horde coming through the open window, and possibly even the air vents in the dash. That sickening, rancid bacon and shit stench. But more than that, he realizes that the strange drone he heard earlier when he rolled down his window, that vibrating hum in the air like the twanging of a million high-tension wires, is the sound of a city full of the dead. Their collective groaning, as they now labor as one giant, multifaceted organism toward the Escalade, makes Philip's skin crawl. All of which leads to one final realization that strikes Philip Blake between the eyes with the force of a ball-peen hammer. It occurs to him, considering the sight unfolding in almost dreamy slow motion in front of him, that the quest to find a refugee center in this town, not to mention anyone still alive, is fast becoming about as prudent as the boy looking for a pony in a pile of horseshit. And that microsecond of dread, that minuscule soupçon of frozen stillness, Philip realizes that the sun will probably not be coming out tomorrow. And the orphans will stay orphans. And the Braves will never again win the fucking pennant. Before jerking the shift lever, he turns to the others, and in a voice laced with bitterness says, "Show hands. How many of y'all still hunt to find that refugee center?" Part 2. Atlanta. He who fights too long against dragons becomes a dragon himself, and if you gaze too long into the abyss will gaze into you. Nietzsche. Chapter 9. Very few production cars on the road, in the U.S. at least, are capable of attaining any kind of speed in reverse. First of all, there's the gear problem. Most cars, vans, pickups, and sport utility vehicles that come off the line have 5 or 6 forward gears, but only 1 for reverse. Second of all, most vehicles have front suspensions designed to go forward, not backward. This prevents drivers from getting up ahead of steam in reverse. Third of all, in reverse, you're usually steering by looking over your shoulder, and pushing cars to top speeds in this fashion usually terminates in spectacular spinouts. On the other hand, the vehicle that Philip Blake is currently commandeering is a 2011 Platinum Cadillac Escalade with all-wheel drive and tricked-out torsion bars for any off-road applications that ace mechanic Calvin R. Donlevy of Green Cove Lane might have endeavored to undertake in the backwaters of central Georgia in happier times. The vehicle weighs in at nearly 4 tons and is close to 17 feet long, with a Stabilitrack electronic stability control system, standard on all Platinum models. Best of all, it's equipped with a rear-view camera that displays on a generous 7-inch navigation screen built into the dash. Without hesitation, his nervous system wired to his right hand, Philip slams the lever into reverse and keeps his gaze riveted to that flickering yellow image materializing on the navigation screen. The image shows the partly cloudy sky over the horizon line of pavement behind them, the top of the overpass. Before the oncoming regiment of zombies have a chance to get within 50 yards, the Escalade rockets backward. The G-forces suck everybody forward, Brian and Nick each twisting around to gaze out the tinted rear window at the overpass rushing toward them, as the tail end of the Escalade shimmies slightly, the vehicle building speed. Philip pushes it hard. The engine screams. Philip doesn't turn around. He keeps his gaze locked onto that screen, the little glowing yellow picture showing the top of the overpass growing larger and larger. One slight miscalculation, a single foot-pound of pressure on the steering wheel in either direction, and the Escalade goes into a spin. But Philip keeps the wheel steady, and his foot on the gas, and his eyes on the screen, as the vehicle tears backward faster and faster. The engine now singing high opera somewhere in the vicinity of C sharp. On the monitor, Philip sees something change. Oh, shit! Look! Brian's voice pierces the noise of the engine, but Philip doesn't have to look. In the little yellow square of video, he sees a series of dark figures appearing a couple hundred feet away, directly in their path at the top of the overpass, like the pickets of a fence. They're moving slowly, in a haphazard formation, their arms opening to receive the vehicle now hurtling directly at them. Philip lets out an angry grunt. He slams both work boots down on the brake pad, and the Escalade skids and smokes to a sudden stop on the sloping pavement. At this point, Philip realizes, along with everybody else, that they have one chance, and the window of that opportunity is going to close very quickly. The dead things coming at them from the front are still 100 yards off, but the hordes behind them, shambling over the crest of the viaduct from the projects and vacant lots around Turner Field, are closing in with alarming speed, considering their ponderous leaden movements. Philip can see in a side mirror that an adjoining street called Memorial Drive is accessible between 2 overturned trailers, but the army of zombies that are looming close and closer in his rear view will be reaching that cross street very soon themselves. He makes an instantaneous decision and bangs down on the accelerator. The Escalade roars backward. Everybody holds on. Philip backs it straight toward the crowd of shuffling corpses. On the video monitor, the image shows the columns of zombies excitedly reaching out, mouths gaping, as they grow larger and larger on the screen. Memorial Drive comes into view on the camera, and Philip stomps on the brake. The rear of the Escalade bowls over a row of the undead with a nauseating, muffled drumming noise as Philip rips the shift lever back into drive, his logger boot already pushing the pedal to the floor. They all sink into the upholstery as the SUV lunges forward, Philip taking a sharp left, threading the needle between 2 ruined trailers. Sparks jump in the air as the SUV swipes a side rail, and then, It's through the gap and fleeing down the relatively clear and blessedly zombie-free lanes of Memorial Drive. Hardly a minute goes by before Brian hears the scraping noise. It's a coarse, wet, keening sound coming from under the chassis. The others hear it too. Nick looks over his shoulder. What the hell's that noise? Something's caught under the wheels, Brian says, trying to see the side of the car out of his window. He can't see anything. Philip is silent, his hands welded to the steering wheel, his jaw set and tense. Nick is looking out at the side mirror.
One of those things is stuck under the wheel.
Oh, great, Brian says, twisting in his seat. He notices a tiny fan of blood droplets across the back window.
What are we gonna...
Let it ride along, Philip says flatly, not taking his eyes off the street. It'll be Pope in a few minutes. They get about 6 blocks, bumping across a set of railroad tracks, getting deeper into the city, before encountering much more than a few isolated wrecks and roaming dead. The gridded streets threading between the buildings is choked with debris, the remnants of explosions, burned cars filled with charred skeletons, windows blown out, and piles of trash and detritus drifted up against storefronts. Somewhere along the way, the scraping noises cease, although nobody sees what has happened to the hanger-on. Philip decides to take a north-south street into the heart of the city, but when he turns right, swerving around a mangled delivery truck on its side in the center of the intersection, he hits the brakes. The Escalade jerks to a stop. They sit there for a moment, the engine idling. Philip doesn't move, his hands still white-knuckling the wheel, his eyes squinting as he gazes into the distant shadows of tall buildings straight ahead. At first, Brian can't see what the problem is. He cranes his neck to glimpse the litter-strewn city street stretching many blocks before them. Through the tinted glass, he sees high-rises on either side of the four-lane avenue. Trash swirls in the September wind. Nick is also puzzled by the sudden stop.
What's wrong, Philip?
Philip doesn't respond. He keeps staring straight ahead with that uneasy stillness, his teeth clenching, his jaws working.
Philip.
No response. Nick turns back to the windshield and stares out at the street. His expression tightens. He sees now what Philip sees. He gets very still.
Will somebody tell me what's going on?
Brian says, leaning forward to see better. For a moment, all he can make out is the distant canyon of high-rises and many blocks of debris-littered pavement. But he realizes soon enough that he's seeing a still life of a desolate city beginning to rapidly change, like a giant organism reacting to the intrusion of foreign bacteria. What Brian sees through that shaded window glass is so horrible that he begins moving his mouth without saying anything. In that single instant of brain-numbing awe, Brian Blake flashes back to a ridiculous memory from his childhood, the madness of the moment gripping his mind. One time his mom took him and Philip to the Barnum and Bailey Circus in Athens. The boys were maybe 13 and 10, respectively, and they reveled in the high-wire acts, the tigers jumping through flaming rings, the men shooting out of cannons, the acrobats, the cotton candy, the elephants, the sideshows, the sword swallower, the human dartboard, the fire eaters, the bearded ladies, and the snake charmer. The memory that sticks with Brian the most, and what he thinks of right at this moment, is the clown car. That day in Athens, at the height of the show, a little goofy car pulled out across the center ring. It was a cartoonish sedan with painted windows, about the size of a station wagon, built low to the ground and painted in a patchwork of day-glow colors. Brian remembers it so vividly, how he laughed his head off at the clowns piling out of the car one after another, and how at first it was just funny, and then it became kind of amazing, and finally it was just downright bizarre, because the clowns kept coming. 6, 8, 10, 20... Big ones, little ones, they kept climbing out of that car as though it was a magic container of freeze-dried clowns.
Even as a 13-year-old, Brian was transfixed by the gag, knowing full well there had to be a trick to it. Maybe a trap door embedded in the sawdust beneath the car, but it didn't matter because the very sight of it was mesmerizing. That exact phenomenon, or at least a perverted facsimile of it, is now unfolding right before Brian's eyes along an urban thoroughfare in the lower bowels of Midtown Atlanta. He gapes silently at it for a moment, trying to put the gruesome spectacle into words.
"Turn around, Philip."
Brian's voice sounds hollow and reedy in his own ears as he stares at the countless throngs of undead awakening in every corner of the city before them. If the horde they encountered only moments ago on their way into town was a regiment of a Roman army, this is the whole empire. As far as the eye can see, down the narrow channel of the four-lane street, the undead emerge from buildings, from behind cars, from within wreckage, from the shadows of alleys, from busted-out display windows, from the marble porticos of government buildings, from the spindly planters of decorative trees, and from the tattered remains of sidewalk cafes. They're even visible in the far distance, where the vanishing point of the street blurs into the shadows of skyscrapers, the ragged silhouettes appearing like a myriad of slow-moving bugs roused from the darkness of an overturned rock. Their number defies logic.
"We gotta get out of here,"
Nick says in a rusty squeak of a voice. Philip, still stoic and silent, works his clenched fingers on the steering wheel. Nick nervously shoots a glance over his shoulder.
"We gotta go back."
"He's right, Philip,"
Brian says, putting a hand gently on Penny's shoulder.
"What's the matter? What are you doing?"
Nick looks at Philip.
"Why aren't you turning around?"
Brian looks at the back of his brother's head.
"There's too many of them, Philip. There's too many of them. There's too many. Oh my God, we're fucked. We're fucked,"
Nick says, transfixed by the ghastly miracle building across their path. The closest ones are maybe half a block away, like the leading edge of a tsunami. They look like office dwellers of both genders, still clad in corporate attire that appears shredded and chewed up and dipped in axle grease, and they stagger this way like snarling sleepwalkers. Behind them, for blocks and blocks, countless others stumble along the sidewalks and down the center of the street. If there's a rush hour in hell, it most certainly can't hold a candle to this. Through the Escalade's air vents and windows, the tuneless symphony of 100,000 moans raises the hackles on the back of Brian's neck, and he reaches over and taps his brother on the shoulder.
"The city's gone, Philip." Yeah, he's right, the place is toast, we gotta turn around,"
Nick babbles.
"One second."
Philip's voice is ice cold.
"Hold on." "Philip, come on," Brian says. "This place belongs to them now."
"I said hold on."
Brian stares at the back of his brother's head, and a cold sensation trickles down Brian's spine. He realizes that what Philip means by the phrase, "hold on," is not, "hold on a second while I think this over," or, "hold on for a minute while I figure this thing out." What Philip Blake means by "hold on" is,
"Y'all got your seatbelts on?"
he asks rhetorically, making Brian's skin turn cold.
"Philip, don't!"
Philip kicks the foot feed. The Escalade erupts into motion. He steers the vehicle straight into the teeming mob, cutting off Brian's thoughts and pressing everybody into their seats.
"Philly, no!"
Nick's warning cry dissolves into a salvo of muffled thumps, like the beating of a giant tom-tom drum, as the Escalade jumps the sidewalk and mows down at least 3 dozen zombies. Tissue and fluid drain across the car. Brian is so unnerved that he ducks down against the floor and joins Penny in that place called away. The smaller ones go down like ducks in a shooting gallery, bursting apart under the wheels and leaving a trail of rotting innards. The larger ones bounce off the quarter panels and hurtle through the air, smacking the sides of buildings and coming apart like overripe fruit. The dead seem to have no capacity to learn.
Even a moth will flitter away once it flies too close to a flame. But this vast society of walking corpses in Atlanta apparently have no clue as to why they can't eat the shiny black thing roaring at them, the same thundering piece of metal that just an instant ago turned their fellow zombies into blood pudding, so they just keep coming. Hunched over the wheel, teeth gnashing, knuckles white, Philip uses the wipers with periodic sprays of cleaning solution to keep the windshield clean enough to see through as he chews his way north, plowing the 8,300 pounds of Detroit iron through the moving sea of zombies. Varying his speed between 30 and 50 miles an hour, he carves a path toward the center of town. At times, he's literally cutting a swath through a crowd so dense that it's like blazing a trail through a thick forest of blood fruit, the flailing arms and curled fingers like tree limbs, clawing at the side windows as the Escalade digs through the walking excrement. At other times, the SUV crosses short sections of clear street, with only a few zombies trundling along on a sidewalk or at the edges of the pavement, and this gives Philip a chance to get his speed up and to swerve to the right to pick a few off, and then to the left for a few more, and then he'll hit another wall-to-wall mob, and that's probably the most fun, because that's when the shit really flies. It's almost as though the viscera is raining down from above, from the sky, rather than from under the wheels or along the frame or over the top of the big front grille as the Escalade shears through the bodies. The wet matter streaks across the glass again and again with the rhythm of a giant pinwheel, a kaleidoscope of color, the palette like a rainbow of human tissue, oxblood red, pond scum green, burnt ochre yellow, and pine tar black. And it's almost kind of beautiful to Philip. He roars around a corner and plunges into another mass of zombies coming down the street. The strangest part is the continual repetitive flashes of similar tissues and organs, some of them recognizable, some of them not so recognizable. Entrails fly in all directions, splashing the windshield and sliding across the hood. Little kernels of teeth periodically gather in the wiper blades, and something else, something pink, like little pearls of fish roe, keeps collecting in the seams of the hood. Philip glimpses dead face after dead face, each one flashing in his window, visible one moment, gone the next. And he's in his zone now. He's somewhere else, not in the SUV, not behind the wheel, but inside the mob. Inside the city of undead, chewing through their ranks, devouring the motherfuckers. Philip is the baddest monster of them all. And he's gonna make it through this ocean of shit if he has to tear down the entire universe. Brian realizes what's happening before he even looks. 10 excruciating minutes after they started mowing through the sea of zombies, after making it across nearly 23 city blocks, the Escalade goes into a spin. The centripetal force tugs Brian against the floor, and he pops his head up, peering over the seat, as the SUV slides sideways on the grease of 50,000 corpses. He has no time to yell or do anything about what's happening. He can only brace himself and penny against the seat backs for the inevitable impact. Wheels slick with gore, the SUV does a 360, the rear end windmilling through the last few stray cadavers. The city blurs outside the windows, and Philip fights the wheel, tries to straighten it, but the tires are hydroplaning on a sheet of intestines and blood and spore. Brian lets out a strangled yelp, part warning and part inarticulate cry, as the vehicle spins toward a row of storefronts. In the frenzied moments before the crash, Brian glimpses a row of derelict shop windows, hatless busts of bald mannequins, empty jewelry displays, frayed wires growing out of vacant floorboards, all of it blurred behind the wire mesh display windows. But it's just a vague impression of these things, Brian's vision distorted by the violent spinning of the SUV. And that's when the right side of the Escalade collides with the display window. The crash has that suspension of time feeling for Brian, the store window turning to stardust, the noise of shattering glass like a wave slamming a breakwater as the Escalade punctures the burglar bars and plunges sideways into the dark shadows of the Goldberg Fine Jewelry Center of Atlanta. Counters and display cases explode in all directions, a sparkling, silver sleet of debris as the gravitational forces yank all passengers to the right, The Escalade's airbags deploy in tiny explosions, great heaving balloons of white nylon filling the interior before it has a chance to collapse, and Nick is thrown sideways into the white fabric. Philip is flung sideways into Nick, and Penny is thrown across the rear floor into Brian. The SUV skids sideways for an eternity through the empty store. The vehicle finally comes to rest after slamming hard into a weight-bearing pillar in the center of the store, shoving everybody hard against the padded lining of the airbags. And for a moment, nobody moves. White, feathery debris snows down through the dark, dusty air of the jewelry store, and the sounds of something collapsing behind them creaks in the sudden silence. Brian glances through the cracked rear window and sees the front of the store, a pile of fallen girders blocking the hole in the window, a cloud of dust obscuring the street. Philip is twisting around in his seat, his face ashen and wild with panic.
Pumpkin, Pumpkin, you okay? Talk to me, little girl, you all right?
Brian turns to the child, who's still on the floor, looking woozy and maybe in some kind of shock, but otherwise unharmed.
She's good, Philip. She's good,
Brian says, feeling the back of the child's head for any blood, any sign of injury. She seems fine.
Everybody else okay?
Philip looks around the dust motes of the dark interior. A thin ray of daylight filtering across the store is the only illumination. In the gloom, Brian can see the other men's faces. Sweaty. Stone still with terror. Eyes glinting. Nick raises a thumb.
I'm good.
Brian says he is too. Philip already has his door open and is struggling out from behind the airbag.
Get everything you can carry, he tells them. But make sure you get the shotguns and all the shells, you hear me?
Yes, they hear him. And now Brian and Nick are climbing out of the SUV. Over the course of a mere minute, Brian makes a series of observations, most of them, apparently, already calculated by Philip, beginning with the front of the store. From the chorus of moaning noises and thousands of shuffling feet, it's clear to Brian that the zombie horde is closing in on the accident scene. The Escalade is finished, its front end nearly totaled, its tires blown, its entire length shellacked with gore. The rear of the store leads toward a hallway. Dark, narrow, lined with drywall. The corridor may or may not lead to an exit. There's no time to investigate. All they have time to do is grab their packs, their duffels, and their weapons. Dazed from the collision, dizzy with panic, bruised and battered, ears ringing, Brian and Nick each grab a goose gun, and Philip takes as many bladed tools as he can stow on his body, a bad axe in each side of his belt, the Ruger, and three extra magazines.
Come on, kiddo. We gotta skedaddle,
Brian says to Penny, but the child looks lethargic and confused. He tries to pull her from the mangled interior, but she hangs on to the back of the seat.
Carrier,
Philip says, coming around the front of the SUV.
Come on, sweetie, you can ride piggyback,
Brian tells the girl. Penny reluctantly climbs out, and Brian lifts her onto his back. The four of them quickly creep through the jewelry store's back hall. They get lucky. Just past the glass doorway of a back office, they find an unmarked metal door. Philip throws the bolt and he cracks the door open a few inches, peering out. The smell is incredible. A black, greasy stench that reminds Brian of the time his sixth grade class took a field trip to the Turner stockyards outside Ashburn. The smell on the abattoir floor was like this. Philip raises a hand, motioning for everybody to stop. Over Philip's shoulder, Brian can see a long, narrow, dark alley lined with overflowing garbage dumpsters. But it's the actual content of the receptacles that registers most sharply in Brian's brain. Pale human arms dangling over the sides, ragged, ulcerated legs, matted hair hanging down, and pools of old blackened blood dried beneath them. Philip motions to the others.
"You'll follow me? And do exactly what I say," he says, snapping the cocking mechanism on the Ruger.
8 rounds of .22 caliber bullets ready to rock, and then he's moving. They follow him out. As quietly and quickly as possible, they make their way through the stench and shadows of the deserted slaughterhouse of an alley toward a side street visible at one end. Weighed down by the duffel bag over one shoulder and the child clinging to his back, Brian limps along in between Philip and Nick, Penny's 65 pounds never feeling as heavy as they do now. Nick, who's bringing up the rear, walks with his Marlin 20 gauge cradled in his arms. Brian has his own shotgun wedged underneath his backpack. Not that he has any idea how to use the damn thing. They reach the end of the alley, and they're about to slip out and make their way down the deserted side street, when Philip accidentally steps on a human hand protruding from under a garbage dumpster. The hand, connected to a zombie with some fight still in it, instantly recoils under the container. Philip jerks backward with a start. "Dude!" Nick cries out, and the hand shoots back out and grabs Philip's ankle. Philip sprawls to the ground, his Ruger spinning off across the pavement. The dead man, an ashy-skinned, bearded homeless person in blood-stained rags, crabs toward Philip with the speed of a giant spider. Philip claws for his gun. The others fumble for their weapons, Brian going for his shotgun while trying to balance the child on his back. Nick thumbs back the hammers on his Marlin. The dead thing clutches Philip's leg and opens its jaws with the rigor mortis creak of rusty hinges as Philip fumbles for his axe. The zombie is about to take a chunk out of Philip's lower calf when the barrel of Nick's goose gun presses down on the back of the thing's skull. The blast rips through the zombie's brain, sending half its face through the air on a geyser of blood and matter, the booming echo of the shotgun reverberating through the canyons of steel and glass. "Now we're screwed," Philip says, struggling to his feet, scooping up the Ruger. "What's the matter?" Brian says, adjusting the weight of the little girl on his back. "Listen," Philip says. In the brittle silence, they hear the ocean wave sound of moaning suddenly change, altering its course as though on a shifting wind, the masses of undead drawn by the boom of the shotgun. "So, we'll go back inside," Nick says in a strident, tense voice. "Back inside the jewelry store, there's gotta be a second floor." "Too late," Philip says, checking the Ruger, looking down into its breech. He's got 4 rounds of hollow tips left in the hilt and 3 mags of 8 each in his back pockets. "I'm betting they're already flooding in the front of the place." "What do you suggest?" Philip looks at Nick and then at his brother. "How fast you think you can run with all that weight?" They take off at a moderate clip, Philip in the lead, Brian hobbling along after him, Nick bringing up the rear, past caved-in storefronts and petrified, charred funeral pyres of bodies burned by enterprising survivors. Brian can't tell for sure, but it seems like Philip is madly looking for a safe exit off the streets, a clean doorway, a fire escape ladder, something. But he's distracted now by an increasing number of moving corpses appearing around every corner. Philip blasts the first one at 50 paces, sending a slug through its forehead, dropping in like a bad habit. The second one surprises him at closer range, lurching out of a shadowy doorway, and Philip puts it down with the second shot. More of them are materializing from porches and gaping store windows. Nick puts the goose gun and 2 decades of boar hunting to good use, taking down at least a dozen of them in the space of 2 blocks. The blasts echo up over the skyline like sonic booms in the stratosphere. They turn a corner and hurry down a narrower side road of herringbone brick, perhaps a landmark antebellum street that once rang with buckboards and horses, now bordered on either side by boarded condominiums and office buildings. The good news is that they seem to be moving away from the congested area, encountering fewer and fewer walking dead with each passing block. The bad news is that they feel trapped now. They sense the city closing in around them, swallowing them whole in its glass and steel gullet. By this point, the sun has begun its afternoon descent, and the shadows thrown by the massive skyline have begun to lengthen. Philip sees something in the distance, maybe a block and a half away, and instinctively ducks under the canopy of a torn awning. The others hunker down with him against the boarded window of a former dry cleaner, and they crouch in the shadows to catch their breaths. Brian is panting with exertion, little Penny still clinging soporifically to his back, like some kind of sleepy, traumatized monkey. "What is it? What's the matter?" Brian asks, realizing that Philip is craning his neck to see something in the distance. "Tell me I'm seeing things," Philip says. "What is it?" "Gray building up there on the right," Philip says, nodding to the north. "See it? About 2 blocks away. See the doorway?"
In the distance, a three-story apartment building rises out of a row of dilapidated two-story condominiums. A massive post-war pile of chalk-colored brick and jutting balconies. It's the largest building on the block. The top of it reaching out of the shadows and reflecting the cold, pale sunlight off its array of antennas and exhaust stacks.
Oh my God, I see it!
Brian utters, still balancing Penny on his sore back as he kneels. The child clutches at his shoulders with a desperate grip.
That ain't no mirage, Philly,
Nick comments, a trace of awe coloring his voice. They all stare at the human figure in the distance, too far away to identify as a man or a woman, adult or child. But there it is, waving at them. Chapter 10. Philip approaches cautiously from the opposite side of the street, the .22 at his side, cocked and ready but not exactly raised. The others follow along behind him in a single file, all of their hackles up, their eyes wide open and prepared for anything. The young woman across the street calls to them in a low, hissing whisper.
Hurry up already!
She appears to be in her late 20s, maybe early 30s, with long, dishwater blonde hair pulled back in a tight ponytail. She wears jeans and a loose-fitting cable-knit sweater that's severely stained, the red smudges and spatters visible even from this distance as she waves them over with a small-caliber revolver, maybe a Police 38, swinging it like it's an air traffic control baton. Philip wipes his mouth, thinking, catching his breath, trying to get a bead on the woman.
Come on, she yells, before they smell us!
She's obviously anxious for them to follow her inside, and it's very likely she means them no harm. The way she's swinging the gun, it wouldn't surprise Philip if it wasn't even loaded. She calls out,
and don't let any of those biters see you come inside!
Philip is wary, guarded, and he pauses on the curb before crossing the street.
How many of you are there?
He calls out to her. Across the street, the blonde woman lets out an exasperated sigh.
For God's sake, we're offering you food and shelter. Come on! How many? Jesus, do you want help or not?
Philip tightens his grip on the Ruger.
You're gonna answer my question first.
Another nervous sigh.
Three, okay? There's three of us. You happy now? This is your last opportunity, because if y'all don't come now, I'm gonna go back inside, and then you're gonna be shit out of luck.
She speaks with the faint drawl of a native Georgian, but has some big city in her voice, too. Maybe even a little bit of the North. Philip and Nick exchange glances. The distant choir of rusty moaning drifts closer on the wind like a coming storm. Brian nervously readjusts Penny's weight on his back, and then shoots a jittery glance over his shoulder at the end of the block. He looks at Philip.
What other options do we have, Philip?
I agree, Philly,
Nick whispers under his breath, swallowing his fear. Philip looks at the young lady across the street.
How many men? How many women?
She hollers back at him.
You want me to fill out a questionnaire? I'm going back inside. Good luck with everything. You're gonna need it. Wait!
Philip nods at the others, and then cautiously leads them across the street. You got any cigarettes? The young woman asks, leading the group into the building's outer vestibule, securing the door behind her with a makeshift cross brace. We're down to our last bent butts. She's a little beat up, with scars on her chin, bruises on the side of her face, and one eye that's so bloodshot it looks like a mild hemorrhage. Beyond those rough edges, though, she strikes Philip as a fine-looking woman, with cornflower blue eyes and the kind of sun-kissed skin you might see on a farm girl, a sort of easy, low-maintenance beauty. But from the defiant tilt of her head and the Zoftig curves hidden under her bulky clothes, she gives off the air of an Earth Mother, and one does not fuck with Earth Mothers.
Sorry, no smokers,
Philip says, holding the door for Brian.
Y'all look like you got banged up out there,
the woman says, leading them across a reeking, littered chamber lined on one side with 18 pairs of mailboxes and buzzers. Brian gently puts Penny down. The little girl staggers for a moment, getting her bearings. The air smells of must and zombie. The building doesn't feel safe. The young woman kneels down by Penny.
Aren't you a sweet one?
Penny doesn't say anything, just looks down. The woman looks up at Brian.
She yours?
She's mine, Philip says.
The woman brushes a strand of matted black hair from Penny's face.
My name's April, honey. What's yours? Penny?
The voice that comes out of the child is so meek and nerve-wracked it sounds like the mewl of a kitten. The woman named April smiles and strokes the girl's shoulder, then rises and looks at the men.
Let's get inside before we draw more of those things.
She goes over to one of the intercoms and thumbs the button.
Dad, let us in.
Through a burst of static, a voice replies,
Not so fast, little girl.
Philip grabs her arm.
You got power in there? You got electricity?
She shakes her head.
Afraid not. Intercom's on a battery.
She pokes the button.
Dad, come on.
Through the crackling static.
How do we know we can trust these yahoos?
Click.
You gonna let us in or what?
Crackle.
You tell them to give up their guns.
She lets out another anguished sigh and turns to Philip, who's shaking his head, giving a no-way-in-hell kind of look.
Click. They got a little girl, for Christ's sakes. I'll vouch for him.
Crackle.
And Hitler painted roses. We don't know these folks from Adam.
Click.
Dad, open the damn lock.
Crackle.
You saw what happened up to Druid Hills.
April slams her hand down on the intercom.
This ain't Druid Hills. Now let us in, goddammit, before we grow moss on our asses.
A harsh metallic buzz is followed by a loud clunk as the auto latch on the inner security door springs open. April leads him through the doorway and then down a shop-worn, sour-smelling hallway with three apartment doors on either side. At the far end of the corridor stands a metal door marked Stairs, with crisscrossing boards nailed over it. April knocks on the last door on the right, apartment 1C, and within moments, a heavier, older, coarser version of April opens the door.
Oh my God, what an adorable little girl, the big gal says, seeing Penny, who is now holding Brian's hand. Come on in, folks. Can't tell you how good it is to finally see people who can keep the drool in their mouths.
April's sister, who introduces herself as Tara, is plump and rough around the edges. She smells of smoke and cheap shampoo, and is dressed in a faded floral print muumuu to hide her excess flesh. Her cleavage rises like bread dough out of the top of her dress, a little Woody Woodpecker tattoo on the crest of one bosom. She has the same striking blue eyes as her younger sister, but keeps them heavily lined and decorated with steel blue eyeshadow. Her long Lee press-on nails look like they can open a tin can. Philip enters the apartment first, the Ruger still in his hand at his side. The others follow. At first, Philip barely notices the cluttered living room, the chairs draped with clothing, the battered luggage along one wall, and the oddly shaped musical instrument cases leaning against the boarded sliding door. He hardly notices the small kitchenette off to the left, the peach crates of provisions and the sink full of dirty dishes. The smell of cigarette smoke and stale fabric and dried sweat hanging in the air barely registers in Philip's nostrils. Right now, all he can focus on is the barrel of a 12-gauge shotgun pointed directly at him from a rocking chair across the room.
That's far enough, says the old man with the shotgun.
A lanky, weathered old duffer. He has the farmer-tanned face of a cigar store Indian, with an iron-gray flat-top haircut and ice-chip blue eyes. The slender tube of an oxygen rig is clipped under his buzzard's beak of a nose, the tank sitting next to him like a faithful pet. He barely fits into his stovepipe jeans and flannel shirt, his white, hairy ankles showing above the tops of his shit-kickers. Philip instinctively raises the .22, instantly going into Mexican showdown mode. He aims it at the old man and says,
Sir, we got enough trouble out there. We don't need any in here.
The others freeze. April pushes her way past the men.
For God's sake, Dad, put that thing down.
The old man waves the girl aside with the barrel. You hush now, little girl. April stands there with her hands on her hips, a disgusted look on her face. Across the room, Tara says, "Can we all just dial it down a little bit?"
"Where'd you folks come from?"
the old man asks Philip, the shotgun still raised and ready.
"Waynesboro, Georgia."
"Never heard of it."
"It's in Burke County."
"Hell, that's almost South Carolina."
"Yes, sir."
"You on drugs? Speed? Crack? Something like that?"
"No, sir."
"Why the hell would you think that?"
"Something going on behind them eyes.
They look all jacked up on speed."
"I don't do drugs."
"How'd you end up on our doorstep?"
"Heard there was some kind of refugee center set up here, but it ain't looking too good."
"You got that right," says the old man.
April chimes in. "Sounds like we all got something in common."
Philip keeps his eye on the old man, but says to the girl,
"How's that?"
"That's the same reason we ended up in this godforsaken place," she says. "Looking for that damned refugee center everybody was talking about."
Philip stares at the shotgun.
"Best laid plans, I guess."
"Damn straight," says the old man, the faint whistle of oxygen seeping from the tank. "I don't suppose you realize what you've done to us."
"I'm listening."
"You got them biters all stirred up. By sundown, there's gonna be a goddamn convention of them things outside our door."
Philip sniffs.
"I'm sorry about that, but it ain't like we had a choice."
The old man sighs.
"Well, now, I suppose that's true."
"Your daughter's the one pulled us off the street. We had no bad intentions. Hell, we had no intentions at all, other than keeping from getting bit."
"Yeah, well, I could see your point there."
A long beat of silence follows. Everybody waits. The two firearms begin to lower.
"What are them cases for?"
Philip finally asks, nodding toward the row of tattered instrument cases across the rear of the living room. His gun is still raised, but the fight-or-flight juice is drained from him.
"You got Tommy guns in them things?"
The old man finally lets out a flinty laugh. He lays his gun on his lap, crosswise, letting up on the hammers, all the tension draining out of his gaunt face. The oxygen tank pings.
"My friend, you're looking at what's left of the world-famous Chalmers Family Band, stars of stage, screen, and state fairs across the South."
The old man sets the gun down on the floor with a grunt. He looks up at Philip.
"I apologize for the ornery reception."
He struggles to his feet, rising to his full height until he looks like a withered Abe Lincoln.
"Name's David Chalmers, mandolin, vocals, and father of these two ragamuffins."
Philip shoves his gun back behind his belt.
"Philip Blake. This is my brother Brian. And that wallflower over there is Nick Parsons, and I thank you kindly for saving our asses out there."
The two patriarchs shake hands, and the tension goes out of the room with the suddenness of an off switch being thrown. It turns out there was a fourth member of the Chalmers family band, Mrs. Chalmers, a portly little matron from Chattanooga who sang high soprano on the group's bluegrass and old-timey numbers. According to April, it was a blessing in disguise that the matriarch of the family succumbed to pneumonia 5 years earlier. If she had lived to see this horrible shit inflicting the human race, she would have been crushed, would have seen it as the end time, and probably would have walked right off the pier at Clark's Hill Lake. So it was that the Chalmers family band became a trio and went on with the act, playing the Kearney circuit across the tri-state area with Tara on bass, April on guitar, and Daddy on mandolin. As a single father, the 66-year-old David had his hands full. Tara was a pothead, and April had her mother's temper and single-mindedness. When the plague broke out, they were in Tennessee at a bluegrass festival, and they made their way back home in the band's camper. They got as far as the Georgia border before the camper broke down. From there, they got lucky enough to find an Amtrak train that was still running between Dalton and Atlanta. Unfortunately, The train deposited them smack dab in the middle of the southeast side, at King Memorial Station, which was now lousy with the dead. Somehow they managed to work their way north without getting attacked, traveling at night in stolen cars, searching for the mythical refugee center. And that's how we ended up here in our little low-rent paradise, April tells Philip in a soft voice late that night. She sits on the end of a tattered sofa, while Penny dozes restlessly next to her in a wad of blankets. Philip sits nearby. Candles are lit on the coffee table. Nick and Brian are asleep on the floor across the room, while David and Tara are each snoring in a different musical key in their respective rooms. We're too petrified to go upstairs, though, April adds with a trace of regret in her voice. Even though we could use whatever supplies are still up there. Batteries, canned goods, whatever. Jesus, I'd give my left tit for some toilet paper.
Never give that up for a little toilet paper, Philip says with a grin,
sitting barefoot in his stained t-shirt and jeans at the other end of the sofa, his belly full of rice and beans. The Chalmers' supplies are running low, but they still had half of the 10-pound bag of rice that they pilfered from a broken shop window a week ago, and enough beans to make dinner for everyone. April cooked. The grub wasn't bad, either. After dinner, Tara rolled cigarettes with the last of her Red Man tobacco and a few buds of skunkweed. Philip partook in a few puffs, even though he had sworn off pot years ago. It usually made him hear things in his head that he didn't want to hear. Now his brain feels woolly and thick in the strange afterglow. April manages a sad smile. Yeah, well. So close and yet so far.
What do you mean?
Philip looks at her, and then slowly looks up at the ceiling.
Oh. Right.
He remembers hearing the noise earlier and making note of it. They've quieted down now, but the shuffling, creaking noises from the higher floors have intermittently been crossing the ceiling all evening, moving with the insidious, invisible presence of termites. The fact that Philip almost forgot about these noises is a testament to how desensitized he's becoming to the prospects of such proximity to the dead.
What about the other ground floor apartments?
He asks her. We picked them clean. Got every last bit of usable stuff out of them.
What happened in Druid Hills?
He asks after a moment of silence. April lets out a sigh.
Folks told us there was a refugee center up there.
There wasn't. Philip looks at her.
And?
April shrugs.
We got there and found a whole bunch of people hiding out behind the gates of this big scrap metal place. People just like us, scared, confused. We tried to talk some of them into leaving with us, strength in numbers, all that gung-ho shit.
So what happened?
I guess they were too scared to leave and too scared to stay.
April looks down, her face reflecting the candlelight. Tara and Dad and I found a car that would run, and we gathered up some supplies and took off. But we heard the motorcycles coming when we were pulling away.
Motorcycles?
She nods, rubs her eyes.
We got about a quarter of a mile down the road, maybe not even that far. And we round this hill, and all of a sudden we hear, way in the distance behind us, these screams. And we look back across the valley, where this dusty old salvage yard is, and it's like, I don't know, a fucking road warrior or something.
It's what?
This motorcycle gang is tearing the place apart, running people down, entire families, God knows what else. He was pretty damn ugly. And the weird thing is, it wasn't the near miss that got to us. It wasn't the bullet we dodged. I think it was the guilt. We all wanted to go back and help and be good upstanding citizens and all that, but we didn't.
She looks at him.
Because we ain't good upstanding citizens. There ain't any of those left.
Philip looks at Penny.
I can see why your daddy wasn't crazy about the idea of taking in boarders.
Ever since that scrapyard fiasco, he's been real paranoid about running across any survivors. Maybe more paranoid than he is about the biters. Biters. I heard you say that before. Who came up with that one? That's my dad's term. It kind of stuck. I like it. Philip smiles at her again. And I like your daddy. He takes care of business, and I don't blame him for not trusting us. He seems like a tough old nut, and I respect that. We need more like him. She sighs. He's not as tough as he used to be, I'll tell you that. What's he got? Lung cancer? Emphysema? That's not good, Philip says. And then he sees something that stops him cold. April Chalmers has her hand on Penny's shoulder and is almost absently stroking the little girl as she sleeps. It's such a tender, unexpected gesture, so natural, that it reaches down into Philip and awakens something inside him that's long been dormant. He can't understand the feeling at first, and his confusion must be showing on his face because April looks up at him. You okay? Yeah, I'm good. He touches the band-aid on his temple where he smacked himself in the collision earlier that day. The Chalmerses dug out their first aid kit and patched everybody up before dinner. Tell you what, Philip says. You go get some sleep. And in the morning, the boys and I'll clear out the upstairs. She looks at him for a moment, like she's wondering whether or not to trust him. The next morning, after breakfast, Philip shows April that his word is good. He enlists Nick, and he grabs extra magazines for the Ruger and a box of shells for one of the Marlins. He shoves the bad axes down either side of his belt and gives a small pickaxe to Nick for close encounters. Pausing by the door, Philip crouches down to tighten the laces of his logger boots, which are so spattered with mud and gore that they look like they're embroidered with black and purple thread. "Y'all be careful up there," old David Chalmers says, standing in the doorway of the kitchenette. He looks gray and washed out in the morning light, leaning on the metal caddy in which his oxygen tank is mounted. The tube under his nose softly whistles with each breath. "Y'all don't know what you're gonna find." "Always," Philip says, tucking his denim shirt inside his jeans, checking the axes for quick and easy access. Nick stands over him, waiting with the goose gun on his shoulder. There's a taut expression on Nick's face, a combination of grim determination and excitement. "Most of them will be on the second floor," the old man adds. "We'll clear them on out. Just watch your backs." "Will do," Philip says, rising to his feet and checking the axes. "I'm coming." Philip whirls around to see Brian standing there with a clean t-shirt on, an REM logo on the front, the pride of Athens, and a dour, purposeful expression on his face. He's cradling one of the shotguns in his arms like it's a living thing. "You sure?" "Hell yeah." "What about Penny?" "The gal's a watcher." "I don't know. Come on," Brian says. "You need an extra pair of eyes up there. I'm up for it." Philip thinks it over. He glances across the living room and sees his daughter sitting Indian style on the floor between the two Chalmers women. The ladies are playing crazy eights with a tattered deck of cards, making Penny periodically smile and slap down a card. It's been a long time since the little girl has smiled. Philip turns to his brother and offers a grin. "That's a spirit." They get up there via the stairs at the end of the first floor corridor. The elevator's at the other end, as dead as the zombies. But first they have to tear the wooden bracings off the door. The noise of axe blows and nails squeaking out seems to stimulate movement above them in the dark chambers behind apartment doors. At one point, Philip passes gas with all the exertion, a reminder of April's bean dinner from the night before.
"Whew, that fart's gonna wipe out more zombies than any 20-gauge shell," Nick comments.
"Hardy har har," Philip says and tears off the last of the bracing planks. On their way up the dark stairwell, Philip says, "Remember, y'all, be quick."
They are slippery motherfuckers, but they're slow as shit and dumber than Nick here.
Hardy haw back at ya,
Nick says, expertly injecting a pair of 20-gauge shells into his goose gun. They reach the top landing and find the fire door to the second floor shut tightly. They pause. Brian is shaking.
Calm down, sport, Philip tells his brother, noticing the barrel of the shotgun is wavering, trembling slightly.
Philip gently pushes the muzzle away from the general vicinity of his ribs.
And try not to accidentally send a ball of that bird shot into one of us.
I got it under control,
Brian retorts in a shaky, tense voice, revealing that he obviously has nothing under control.
Here we go, Philip says.
And remember, go at them hard and quick.
A single fierce kick with the shank of his boot heel sends the door lurching open. Chapter 11. For a millisecond, they stand there with hearts beating like trip hammers. Other than a few scattered candy wrappers and empty, broken pop bottles, and one hell of a lot of dust, the second floor hall, identical to the ground floor corridor, is empty. Dim daylight shines through the far windows and laces through streaks of dust motes, which cant down across the closed doors. 2A, 2C, and 2E along one side, 2B, 2D, and 2F along the other. Nick whispers,
"They're all locked inside their places."
Philip nods.
"Gonna be like shooting fish in a damn barrel."
"Come on, let's do it,"
Brian says unconvincingly.
"Let's get it done."
Philip glances at his brother, then glances at Nick.
"John Rambo here."
They go over to the first door on the right, 2F, and raise the business ends of their guns. Philip snaps the slide on the Ruger. Then he kicks the door in. A giant ball of stink punches them in their faces. It's the first thing that registers. A hideous stew of human degradation, urine and feces, and zombie stench, vying for dominance over the sharper odors of rancid food and moldy bathrooms and mildewed clothes. It's so overwhelming and unbearable that it literally drives the men back a half step each.
"Jesus wept,"
Nick says in a choked utterance, involuntarily averting his face as if the stench is a wind blowing at him.
"Still think my fart stinks?"
Philip says as he takes a careful step into the reeking shadows of the apartment. He raises the .22. Nick and Brian follow with shotguns at the ready, eyes wide and shiny with tension. A moment later, they find four of them in repose, on the floor of a ransacked living room, each one slumped in a corner, slack-jawed and catatonic, growling languidly at the sight of intruders, but too stupid or sick or demented to move, as though they've grown weary of their hellish fate and now forgotten how to use furniture. It's hard to tell in the gloomy light, especially with their faces all bloated and blackened with mortified flesh, but it looks as though it's another family. Mom and Dad and two grown kids. The walls have weird patches of scratch marks, like a giant abstract painting, showing evidence that the things were following some flickering instinct to claw their way out. Philip goes over to the first one, its shark eyes glimmering as the Ruger looms. The blast sends its brains across the Jackson Pollock of scratch marks behind it. The thing sinks to the floor. Meanwhile, Nick is across the room putting another one out of its misery, the boom of the Marlin like a great dry paper sack popping. Brain matter paints the walls. Philip takes the third one down as it's slowly rising, Nick moving towards the fourth. Boom! And the sounds of fluid spattering surfaces are buffered by the ringing in their ears. Brian is standing 10 paces behind them, his gun poised, his spirit drowning inside him on a rising tide of repulsion and nausea.
This is not,
he starts to say, but a flash of movement to his left cuts off his words. The errant zombie comes at Brian from the depths of a side hallway, plunging out of the shadows like a monstrous clown with a black fright wig and candy eyes. Before Brian even has a chance to identify it as a daughter or girlfriend, dressed in a torn robe with one shriveled breast exposed like a flap of chewed meat, the thing pounces on him with the force of a defensive back, making a tackle. Brian sprawls backward to the floor, and it all happens so fast that Philip and Nick have no time to intercede. They're too far away. The moving cadaver lands on top of Brian, the thing snarling with black, slimy teeth, and in that split instant before Brian realizes that he is still holding the shotgun, the zombie opens its jaws so wide it looks as though its skull is about to unhinge. Brian gets one horrible glimpse down the recesses of the thing's throat, an endless black well straight down into hell, before he instinctively jerks the shotgun up. Almost by accident, the muzzle lodges itself into the gaping hole of the thing's mouth, and Brian screams out a garbled cry as he squeezes off a single blast. The back of the thing's skull explodes, sending up a cloud of blood, mist, and tissue. The backwash hits the ceiling in deep purple arterial matter, and Brian is thunderstruck for a moment, his back pinned to the floor. The thing's head is still skewered on the shaft of the shotgun. He blinks. The silver eyes of the girlfriend, or daughter, or whoever she was, are frozen now and fixed on Brian. He coughs and turns away as the girl's head slowly slides down the length of the barrel, a giant shish kebab, the dead eyes still locked on Brian. He feels the moist slime of her face on his hands. He closes his eyes. He can't move. His right hand still glued to the trigger, his left still welded to the stock. He grimaces with horror. Cold laughter brings him back around.
Look who just scored his first touchdown, Philip Blake says, standing over his brother in a